Welcome to The Daily Ben Show, offering insightful and thought-provoking news commentary and analysis from a classically liberal centrist perspective. The show is brought to you by the Institute of Race Relations. Tune in at 4:30 every Monday to Thursday for engaging discussions from our team of analysts and researchers that you won't find anywhere else.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to the Daily Friend Show. I'm your host, Nicholas Larimer, and I'm joined today by two of my colleagues, Terence Corrigan. Terence, how are you?
I'm good, and yourself?
Yeah, you know, we had a pre-show talk, which was a little bit of a downer, so I'm trying to fend that off. But apart from that, I'm all right. And the source of my woe, Mr. Gabriel Krauser. Gabriel, how are you?
I just had lunch, Nick, and that's very good. Lunch is good. It's good to have lunch.
Lunch is very good. And I'm sure that sometime in the future, you will be able to read the things that Gabriel has just been telling us about. And it will make for very good reading, but not great, not very uplifting reading. But anyway.
No, I'm afraid not. I'm afraid there's not all news is good news. In fact, it's hard to find good news.
At the moment, yes. Speaking of bad news, there was a exciting, but well, let me just describe it. There was a presidential debate last night between Donald Trump and Joe Biden, the first of three between the two, and there will also be a vice presidential debate. It was a pretty bruising debate, an enormous amount of interrupting. Trump attacked Biden's son for his drug addiction. He attacked Biden for Biden's record and saying that he had done nothing in his long career, and said that he had been a successful president, saying that, quote, there has never been an administration or president who has done more than I've done in a period of 3.5 years, and that's despite the impeachment hoax. Trump was asked to condemn white supremacists and right-wing militias and asked them not to contribute to the violence in cities, and he said, I asked them to stand back and stand by. But I'll tell you what, somebody's got to do something about Antifa and the left. Biden attacked Trump for his for Trump's response to COVID-19 and his opposition to the Affordable Health Care Act, usually called Obamacare. But he dodged questions on whether he would pack the Supreme Court with more justices, and also did not condemn left-wing agitators such as Antifa, simply quoting a senior member of the FBI who said that Antifa is an idea, not an organization. Both went pretty savagely at each other. Trump said that there's nothing smart about you, Joe, and that Joe Biden had small crowd sizes. Joe Biden replied, calling him a liar, a clown, and saying, will you shut up and keep your yapping, man? The debate moderator, Chris Wallace, tried very hard to control the debate but didn't really succeed. He scolded Trump repeatedly for not following the debate rules by interrupting, and it seemed more like he was playing that of a fighting WWE ref rather than a moderator. Towards the end, Chris Wallace says, gentlemen, I hate to raise my voice, but why shouldn't I be different than the two of you? Post-debate polls of people who watched the debate give a pretty mixed message. Some of them suggested that Biden won by a fair margin. Other polls have suggested that it was a much closer contest, and some have suggested that Trump is in the lead. I talked to some very non-political people who had watched the debate out of interest, and they said they got a pretty poor impression of both candidates, and there was so much interrupting, it was impossible to follow what was going on. So, Terence, let me start with you. You got the chance to watch most of it. What was your impression? Good debate? Bad debate? What's your feeling?
No debate. I think that that fundamentally what happened was that you had two monologues going on that occasionally intersected to throw mud at each other. Now, as you know, Nick, I'm not I don't style myself as the most knowledgeable person in South Africa on American politics, but I do enjoy these debates. I think I remember watching watching Reagan and Mondale when I was very young, and then Dukakis and Bush and their vice presidents. You know, you actually had substance. You had wisecracks, and you had the put downs. I remember, was it Benson saying to Dan Quayle, "You're no Jack Kennedy." you know, I don't think we could even rise to that level of wit here. There was a lot of both of them, I think, were quite flexible with truth. No, it was it's just a sad comment on the state of democratic engagement in one of the world's oldest democracies. Didn't leave me with a happy feeling.
I agree with that completely. I mean, I remember watching some clips from the I think it was the early one of the Bill Clinton elections, 1992, possibly. One of the debates there, and they had like a town hall format, and it was amazing the level of technical detail that both candidates were able to go into, and they were debating issues with the sort of audience members in a very intelligent way. Now, you know, there was still the occasional dirty trick being pulled, but really it was good stuff. It was very enlightening. Gabriel, you often are a source of interesting and contrarian takes. Do you agree with us? Was this a grim debate, or do you see some light in here?
Yeah, okay, let me look for the light. I generally do agree with you. I think that it was good to be reminded of what the tension around healthcare is in the American system. This was the sort of subject matter of around the first 20 minutes, ostensibly, although they sort of raged between topic and topic. And, you know, I think it's just good to remind listeners that that basically one of the successes of the Republican side from their point of view was to repeal the individual mandate aspect of Obamacare. So Obamacare's, you know, Obama's promise was this: we're going to make healthcare costs come down by getting young people that are pretty healthy to buy into the system. They don't want to buy into the system because they don't feel the pain yet, and then they don't get sick very much, so they don't think they really need it. But if you have a healthcare system that's only if you have an insurance system where only old and sick people are buying health insurance, then it's much more expensive. And the more expensive it is, the more sort of middle-aged and younger people stay out of it. So they said, we're going to force everyone to buy healthcare. And this was challenged, and the Supreme Court upheld it by saying, this is a tax. What's going on here is this is just a tax under another name. And by conceding that, they also made it much easier to knock that back without knocking back the whole law. So from 2017, what the Republicans did under Trump was to keep that tax, because it's very hard to change the law without a supermajority. But they could keep the tax, but take it down to $0. So the individual mandate exists theoretically. Everyone who doesn't buy into health insurance has to pay $0 penalty, which means it's effectively gone away. And the question is, so I think that is, you know, that's a development. That has changed things. Is it good enough? No. Trump's argument is, here's how you get things better. You bring down the prices of particular drugs, insulin being one of the most famous issues, because millions of Americans have diabetes, and insulin costs three times more in America than it does in Canada, for example. So he has signed executive orders to bring it down. Have the executive orders really worked? I don't think so. They haven't. It seems to me that they haven't even come into effect. But that's the sort of route that he wants to take, thinking that he won't get anything through the lower house because it's commanded by the Democrats. But that's their sort of approach. Trump's approach is the deal maker approach. You know, I'm going to do great deals with local and foreign companies to bring down the prices, and where needs be, I'll introduce a little bit of legislation. Whereas on the Democrat side, their problem is they want to bring back the individual mandate, but the way they want to sell it now is by, you know, sort of having a socioeconomic tie to it. So theoretically, everyone who's on Medicare has to get onto the Obamacare option. But their problem is, Joe Biden's problem is that he knows that that's also not a proper fix. That's not even getting you back to where they were under Obamacare in 2010. And Joe Biden did nearly lose to Bernie Sanders. And in fact, Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren together were more popular than Joe Biden during the Democratic primary season. And their proposal is basically to get rid of private health insurance in America. So that's not appealing to most citizens. So Joe Biden doesn't want to say that that's what he wants to do, but he doesn't exactly want to say how he wants to go about not doing it, because he doesn't want to alienate a huge part of his Democratic primary base. So this is to say that although, you know, I'm sort of laying in the background to snippets of the debate laid over 20 minutes, which if you add them up together, probably were only 7 minutes. I do think in this sense, both candidates represented the contradictions within their own parties about how to deal with America having the world's largest health bill. On the left, there's a challenge of not wanting to get rid of private insurance because they don't want to let go of their more centrist supporters, but they also don't want to let go of their ultra-left supporters. So they don't want to be clear about what kind of plan they really do have. And on the right, there's this sort of hope that there's this promise that regulating some parts of the market and better deal making internationally are going to bring costs down, which also just rings a little bit hollow given that Trump has had 3.5 years and it's not clear what effect he has had in that time to bring down healthcare costs using that strategy. So I think he's also stuck in a contradiction where he doesn't want to say that he's against Medicare or Medicaid, social welfare programs that are extremely popular in America, because he'll lose the support of some people who rely on that or consider that the right thing. But he also doesn't want to speak towards – he wants to speak out against socialized socialism in healthcare because, you know, that's what his base demands. So they're both kind of stuck in this contradiction. But this – in this sense, that's exactly the same place America's been for the last 15 years. Sometimes it's with more fancy language, and this time it is with more base language. But the issue actually is the same. I suppose in that sense, you know, there's a glimmer of hope if normalcy is a kind of hope. You know, there's just this normal thing where America's stuck on how to deal with healthcare in a very rich country that also has a lot of sick people. And
I think it might be more useful if rather than having another presidential debate, you just explain the two candidates' positions on American TV. That would probably enlighten more people. For sort of final question to you, Terrence, and then I'll go to you again, Gabriel. I think really, you know, most South Africans, they don't really care too much about these issues, except as a sort of interest, maybe as entertainment, maybe as just kind of like a fun exercise. But what they do care about is who wins. Because that will undoubtedly have at least some impact on us. And I think it's kind of difficult after watching that thing to try and declare someone the winner. But if you had to declare someone the winner, if you were forced to, who would you say won that debate, Terrence?
Well, as I say, I question the premise that it was a debate. But look, you know, I would say that, you know, in terms of sheer kind of pile driving, probably Trump. I mean, I think that he managed to sort of, within the very debased terms of this exchange, he managed to push his position, I think, somewhat better than Mr. Biden. I'd just like to pick on something. So South Africans take interest in that. I think a lot of South Africans, you know, consider themselves sort of experts on American politics because America, you know, dominates so much of our popular culture. But I think a lot of South Africans have a sort of ideological investment in this, and I see a lot of this on Facebook. People who have no personal or familial connections to America, it's, you know, maybe, you know, one or two friends or something, you know, will declare themselves to be Republicans or Democrats, you know, something which I always find a bit amusing. I remember there was one commentator who was based in the critically important American primary of Santon, who, you know, spoke about in 2008, 2009, about how he was campaigning for Barack Obama, you know, for all those millions of American voters who were going to turn out at Santa City on the day. But yeah, you know, there's, America holds a certain grip on our consciousness in a way that no other part of the world does. So yes, you know, you may not benefit, you know, one, you know, from a tax cut or from a from an American healthcare system, but people, South Africans have this have this odd tendency to be very invested in that. You know, it's a fascinating cultural phenomenon.
And the same question to you, Gabriel. If you have to choose a winner, who would it be?
I think it's very close to a tie. I think probably I'll also go with Trump, maybe for a slightly different reason. If we leave policy to the side and just talk about manners and decorum, there was something interesting about the difference in the way that they were rude to one another. So Trump used names like he called Elizabeth Warren Pocahontas and made fun of the fact that Joe Biden was last in class. I don't know if that's true or not, but that's what Trump said. Whereas Joe Biden called the president a clown, as you noted earlier. And I think the most insulting thing that sort of came very early on when Chris Wallace asked Joe Biden, the first few minutes of the debate were actually pretty polite. And then Chris Wallace asked Joe Biden, Trump was already interrupting, but they weren't saying acrimonious things to one another. And then Chris Wallace asked Joe Biden, will you pack the Supreme Court? Which was a proposal by, amongst others, Pete Buttigieg, who was my favorite Democratic candidate. Not my favorite proposal. Basically, you know, to get the court to have a lot of Democratic nominees, you take it from 9 justices to 17. And then in one session, you can add a whole bunch of new justices. Yeah. This was something FDR proposed before World War II. Anyway, so Joe Biden didn't want to say yes or no to that again because of contradictions within his own party. And so he didn't want to answer the question. And Trump started interrupting, saying, oh, man, answer the question. And he said, I'm not even going to talk to this man. And I think that is, in a sense, the ultimate insult. The ultimate form of disesteem is to deny, you know, the existence or presence of one of another, or to you know, to say I'm not going to engage with you. You're not even worth talking to. There is something. It's not just rude. It's also sort of antithetical to the nature of a debate. And I think that people who went in there hoping that Joe Biden would be tough and hard, and at the same time would bring a level of gentlemanliness that Trump is lacking to the debate, will have felt left down by Joe Biden's performance, by his willingness to blame all coronavirus deaths on Trump, and then also blame the recession on Trump because Trump shut it, the economy down. He called it your recession and your deaths. You know, that's a kind of dirty tricks thing, which is very common. And Trump played similar dirty tricks. That one seems very severe because the recession is so serious and the death numbers are so high. To say they blame them all on Trump seems crazy. But just at the level of style, I think the way that Trump dissed Biden was more contentful. He didn't give names. He sort of said things about his son and about his school performance and about his 47 years in office, whereas Joe Biden resorted to name calling. And I think that people who are frustrated with Trump's symbolic performance would have been looking to Biden to show something better, and he didn't do that. So maybe I shouldn't say I think Trump won, but I think Biden lost to an extent for that very rare species of person who isn't already committed one way or another, and was hoping that Biden would put a good example forward for how to do this thing. I think they'd feel a bit let down by that. I certainly did.
I think that's a very interesting analysis. And we shall see how it'll affect the race. A lot of commentators are suggesting that it won't really affect much, but no, who knows? Yeah. We shall see over the next coming days. Anyway, let's move back home to SA, where we have a story from the Daily Maverick, which is, I think, a pretty exciting read, even if it's not a very happy one. And this is a story about the level of looting of the infrastructure of Gauteng's rail network. Especially over lockdown, but over the past several years in general. So the journalist who wrote this story, Becky Simelane, who works for the Daily Maverick, said that he walked down some of the railroads and found 5 guys digging up infrastructure and making jokes about how much they had already stolen. And when he asked them, do you feel bad about this? They said, if a money van is prized open and everyone scrambles for cash, you want to tell me you'll stand by and watch. Prasser confirmed in September that only 3 out of 17 rail lines were operational in Gauteng. The mining of rail infrastructure, where people basically steal all the metal, happens basically day and night. Some of the pictures attached to this article were quite spectacular, just the level of how almost everything has been stolen. Anything metal, the sheeting of the train station roofs, tiles being chipped off the walls, taps being stolen, wires being ripped out, railway sleepers and tracks actually being stolen, ripped out. Apparently, according to a response to a DA question in July 2020, there were 1,800 reported incidents of vandalization at train stations in Gauteng over the past 3 years at a replacement cost of in excess of 2 billion rand. In September 2017, the police and Prasa conducted a safety operation in some of the areas affected, but failed to identify the root of the problem, and no one was arrested. In a briefing given by Transport Minister Fikile Mbalula, he said that replacing all of the damage done to the rail infrastructure will cost 4 billion rand. And they also said that the government was looking to increase the number of security guards for the railway infrastructure by 3,000. Gabriel, you've talked a bit about how so much of our wealth in South Africa is stolen or destroyed. Is this really a perfect example of what you're talking about?
Yeah. No. Hats off to Becky Simelane. He's been a good one to follow for many years. And this is not the first time this kind of story has been told, but I think he's done an excellent job of highlighting a perfect example of the broader issue of value grab and destruction. You know, there's two things to note on a general level when you steal. The one thing is that usually, just at a material level, the thing that you've stolen has decreased in value because it's no longer fit to purpose. So if you steal one of the sleepers, one of the metal bars that sits between the tracks and holds the tracks in place, it's very hard to use that anywhere else other than in that function. And you're not going to easily be able to resell it to Prasa. So what you're going to have to do is use it as scrap, melt it down, see if you can find another purpose for it. So all of the effort that went into molding it and putting it into that shape and transporting it to that place is lost. So that's one way that you lose value. The other way that you lose value is when you erode the trust, when you no longer have a sort of chain of custody of ownership, you can only sell on the black market. You can only sell your hot goods on the black market. And there you are, people know that they can't access major capital, so it goes for less. That's the only way that you can get someone to buy your good rather than something that they don't have to worry about the police coming to follow up on them. So this is, this has happened across our infrastructure. If it's not being burnt down, it's being lifted up like that. And I've been in rural South Africa. You see the same thing. If a cow is stolen from a productive farm where it's being inoculated, it's being dehorned, 80% of the cows every year are calving, so your herd is growing at a nice rate, you're selling the wieners off. That cow is part of an important business. You steal that cow and you put it somewhere else, you know where its brand is still on the cow. So you can't put it in a nice, well-functioning farm. You've got to go there, then put it somewhere else where it's not going to be inoculated because people don't want to call in the state vet and they don't want to pay for the inoculations themselves. So then the cow gets a sexually transmitted disease and then it aborts its calves prematurely and so it's no longer fertile, or it gives birth to two-headed calves, or it itself passes away, or it just sort of gets thinner and thinner because the cow is not being well tended with licks in the winter and hay and so on. So, that's another way that a cow that's worth, 250K can become a cow that's worth 150K, or one that's 120 can become worth 50. And those are sort of grassroots stories, the railway stations and the agricultural ones. But you multiply that up across everything that we've been seeing in season 3 of the Zondo Commission, everything you see from SARS, from good investigative journalists that have uncovered massive corruption in pretty much every state-owned enterprise, every branch of the civil service. And you see why it is that South Africa is sitting in this position where it's a relatively productive country with quite low value overall of wealth stock. And that means we don't have the money to deal with problems that we should be dealing with. So every time someone steals like this, they're ultimately stealing from the poor. And I think it's a disgrace. And it's nice to have a very concrete example. And hopefully, as these concrete examples continue to percolate around, people will stand up and say, you know what, if I saw a bunch of money, you know, if I saw a cash armored vehicle that had been tipped over and the back of it was open, I wouldn't go and race to grab the money. I'd go to the driver's seat to see if the guy's dead or alive and see if I can call an ambulance. You know, I think that's how most people think. And it'd be, you know, be nice to see us as a society make our voices heard, those people who do think that way, and drive the change we need.
Terence, do you agree?
You know, I'm old enough to remember in the 1990s there was a sort of travelogue show, Beckett's Trek, done by Dennis Beckett, and he did an episode on this very phenomenon, cable theft. And he said that there's no crime quite like it. He put it like this: if you steal my shirt, I lose a shirt, you gain a shirt. If I steal a length of cable from the railways, you know, I gain maybe enough money to buy breakfast, but I can shut an entire factory down because it can't get its goods from Germiston to Durban to be exported in the importer in India or in America looks elsewhere. There's something that I don't know. It's where perversity meets desperation. It's the only way I can describe it, and where we are dealing with a very severe breakdown of the fibers in society. There are thousands and thousands of people who rely on rail to get them to their jobs if they're lucky enough to have them, to earn a salary, which is probably not that impressive, and this simply takes it away from them.
Yeah, exactly. I think it's actually a really good encapsulation of how complicated some of our problems are. You know, this sort of general culture of people saying to them, you know, I would steal the money from the cash van, the inability of the police, of the security guards, of the government to really prevent this kind of looting. It's absolutely crazy stuff. And as you say, it's really the people who use these services are usually people who are too poor to really afford anything else. These are not luxury trains that people travel on. And so this destruction is really going to hurt them, especially as they try to put their lives back together after the economic calamity of COVID and lockdown. All right, we'll move just in the last minute here, I think, onto the report yesterday that came out from Stats SA saying that the number of jobs lost in the second quarter of 2020 was about 2.2 million. So there are now it went from about 16.3 million to 14.1 million. But as a sort of funny little quirk of the statistics, because basically no one could look for jobs during the lockdown, and because the official unemployment rate requires you to actually be searching for work to be qualified as unemployed, the unemployment rate went down from 30% to 23%, but that's really just sort of a statistical higgledy-piggledy, for want of a technical word. And on the expanded definition of unemployment, it increased by 2.3% to 42% of the population unemployed. So that includes people who have given up searching for work. In 30 seconds, Gabriel, what's your take on these numbers?
Yeah, so the last time we were looking at Stats SA numbers, the economy had halved on an annualized basis, and I said, who's done worse? And then afterwards, I went into the research and saw that our economy actually has halved if you look at our trajectory from 2000 to 2010. And this time, I'm going to ask myself the same question and go and find the truth and to say, you know, which country has an official smaller portion of the population, of the adult population that's employed and not in education. And I'm not sure what the answer is, but I look forward to finding it out because I think we are setting an extraordinary record here, and I think it's terrible, and I think it bodes very poorly for the next few years because recently unemployed people are very unhappy.
Indeed. All right, I believe that's all the time we have for today. Thank you very much for listening to us. Please like, rate, subscribe to support this podcast. We'd love to have your feedback. Please write a review if you have time. And we will catch you tomorrow for the last of the week's editions of the Daily French Show. Have a great day, everyone.